Good afternoon, everyone. As to be expected, this is the last day of the conference, so our audience is on the light side. But thank you for those of you who stuck around. And some of you probably have flights to catch after this. But it's my distinct pleasure to welcome four great panelists today. And this presentation, this panel, has been organized by the Medical Care Section. And the vision we had for this panel was really to look at the drug development process and also what goes possibly wrong at the end of the soup to nuts range of pharmaceutical issues. So we have a flow to our panel. We're going to begin some different ways of thinking about the pharmaceutical development process. We're going to go into a discussion of the use of medications among children and where there might be opportunities for intervention and improvement. And then we have two great presentations to wrap up the session. They're going to talk about or discuss the prescription drug abuse problems in two states, North Carolina and Indiana. And I suspect we're going to have plenty of opportunities for audience discussion. So I know you're sitting in the back, but if you'd like to move up front, that's okay too. We're going to call on you anyway. That's great. So if you'd rather not, that's okay. That's okay. I'm going to begin with introducing Dr. Donald Light. Dr. Donald Light is an international recognized expert on pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical ethics. And he has published in leading medical journals. He has a forthcoming book with his co-author, actually, for this panel as well, Dr. Maturo. And it offers the first working model for a commercial-free pharmaceutical research for clinically superior medicines. And the title is Good Pharma, the remarkable model of the Mario Negri Institute for Pharmacological Research. And this is something that we're going to have the pleasure of hearing about in this discussion as well. The Negrians, Dr. Light is a professor at Rowan University School of Osteopathic Medicine and as well as a visiting researcher at Princeton University. So please help me welcome Dr. Light.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much. So I was looking over the whole panel and thinking, this presentation is about all that's wrong with how we develop, approve, and market drugs that's reflected in the other three papers. So this is sort of the macro view. And so I'm going to go through a bunch of slides quickly, kind of summarizing how profoundly the current system is, and therefore how great the need is to really have a public health-oriented way of developing, approving, and administering drugs. Because what we have now is the opposite of that, facilitated by somewhere between $20 and $50 billion spent on getting physicians to prescribe things that they might not otherwise prescribe. So what would developing pharmaceuticals for public health look like? Well, it would be based on patient and public needs. So Europeans, for example, have a whole unmet needs-based report that provides a reasoned and worked-out foundation for thinking for all of Europe about what unmet needs are. We don't have anything like that here, I don't think. And R&D would be focused on improving patient outcomes, not technical outcomes, not surrogates, not placebos when there already are drugs in the class, which is unethical, by the way. And there would be public funding of R&D and blind reviews. I was lucky to be selected as a fellow at the Harvard Center for Ethics, and I've never seen a center for ethics where every single person is studying institutional corruption in every realm of social life. And one of them, Chris Robertson, is very keen on blind reviews. He thinks all kinds of things would be very much improved by blind reviews. There would be open science and fully transparent results. Some of you may know about the All Trials campaign in London. That's just one little part because things are so corrupted that if tomorrow we had all the results and the All Trials campaign was a roaring success, we would have all the data from biased trials. that do not test against clinical outcomes. So, you know, what really matters is the trial designs. So in an ideal public health pharmaceutical research development and use system, what about patents? Well, we could have a whole other session about that, so I've just put a few bullet points in. One possibility would be to once again exempt medicines from patents, as was done for decades in Europe. Another option, which is actively being pursued in different ways in India and Brazil now, and other sort of developing countries that want to, on one hand, have medicines they can afford, and on the other hand, encourage scientific research and a pharmaceutical industry, is to limit patents in various ways. And another way would be to patent and then issue non-exclusive licenses, which was done earlier in the century. But the result of all that would be you would have research and development around public needs and unmet needs, and you'd end up with low prices rather than prices that are 5,000 to 10,000% more costly than the cost of goods. And by the way, my main project now is with Doctors Without Borders on lowering the prices of HPV vaccines by finding out what COGS is, cost of goods, which is a highly secret number that we're trying to unveil. So instead, we have corporate-controlled R&D process that focuses upon maximizing profits from patents. And sometimes a great drug comes along, and that's wonderful, but most of the time it doesn't. So there are minimum benefits to patients. 85 to 90% of new drugs are judged by independent review bodies as little or no better than existing drugs. And that seems to be the hidden business model of big pharma, to turn out mostly minor variations and minor clinical innovations that generate new patents and new marketing opportunities. And I have cpharmamyths.net. So on pharmamyths.net, you can find all of this work free to download. So here's a picture of the product of the current system of 979 drugs developed over a 10-year period. Two breakthrough drugs, 13 real advances, 61 with some advance, and 918 with little or no improvement. And why is this happening? Because the FDA criteria require little evidence that drugs are clinically better and safer. You surrogate endpoints often that are not solidly verified. And new drugs may be worse. So a new drug that's better than placebo may be worse than the last five drugs that were better than placebo. But you don't know. The trials are designed, and the FDA approves without any knowledge for physicians or anyone else about how much better or worse the drug is. And you have corporate control over the creation of medical knowledge that understates harms and exaggerates benefits, as you would expect from a rational economic model. And there's a whole literature on the large complex network of sponsored clinical scientists, medical writers, and journalists who develop this, and ghost management. Negative results are five times less likely to be published. Positive results are likely to be published twice. So you have we have a double bias in medical knowledge and guidelines. So doctors are actively misled, including things like oxycodone and things that are going to be in the other papers. So we have, now parallel to this is an epidemic of serious risks and harms that parallels all of this. Drugs are the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. They're a major health problem. They're a major cause of hospitalizations, falls, and road accidents as well, particularly trucker accidents with 12-wheelers. 51,900 hospitalizations each week and 2,460 deaths each week attributed to prescription drugs. And I've handed out the kind of summary of the work done at Harvard and with Joel Lexton, who's over here to your right, and Jonathan Darrow. And a 1 in 3 chance of getting a serious warning if reviews are accelerated. So what would be a model of R&D for public health? Well, the Mario Negri Institute for Pharmacological Research, which is a multi-campus institute with over 50 different lab teams in northern Italy, has maintained its independence from both commercial and political influences for over 50 years. It's developed ways to keep control of the research design, the analysis, the data, and publication, even when there's a commercial funder. They write all their own articles. They publish all negative results. If a drug they've helped develop shows evidence of harmful side effects, they're amongst the first to publish. You know that drug we worked on 10 years ago? Well, we're sending out a warning about it because it now looks like it has some serious side effects. And they patent nothing. They patent none of their discoveries because the patenting process distorts research decisions at every point and leads to people thinking, well, what direction will most likely be patented and will interest a venture capitalist? Trials, Mario Negri trials, use only hard clinical endpoints, and they're superiority trials. They're trials that test the degree to which a new drug is superior. This is very rare. It seems, it's like my neighbors think this is what happens all the time. They're not aware that this is actually an oddity. And they use large voluntary networks of specialists to recruit patients. So they have national networks in oncology and cardiology and dermatology, and then they train up the practitioners, which the practitioners love, to kind of learn how to be practicing researchers, and they become co-authors. So you'll have 40 or 60 co-authors on a Mario Negri trial who will be the specialists in the network. It has an informal, open sharing, brainstorming kind of way. It started developing integrated translational research, to use current language, in the 1980s. So it's been very much ahead of its time. This is a slide that tries to capture the way in which they created a fully interactive linkage between bench and bedside, starting in the 80s in beautiful Bergamo, and then on to other sites. Their research output is prodigious. They've had 49,232 citations in 2013 alone. Their H factor is 88, which is very high. This is one little example where they've created a network of ICUs throughout the country, and together they developed criteria for identifying better and not as good use of medicines for intensely serious patients. And the idea is to move the bottom third, who are lower than average mortality, you know, to bend that curve towards the mean while keeping the ones that are better, better. And each year they up their game. And in 7 years they've decreased mortality of ICU patients by 28% and saved about 2,500 lives. They do a great deal of outreach work. It's the only research institute I know that does so much work going out to the public and speaking on talk shows and, you know, like the Today Show or Morning Report, things like that, and having conferences. They even have a training program for training patient group leaders on how to avoid commercial influences and how to do critical assessments for patient groups on their own. They have created a Center for Information for Research on Rare Disease, and in the Italian way, they found a palace that was for sale, a white elephant, and then an anonymous Swiss donor said, well, I'll buy it for you. And she refused to tell her name. Her lawyer was very protective. It took 5 years for Professor Garantini to finally break through. And they said, well, you know, we need to take these 270 bedrooms and convert them into labs. And how much would that be? She said, well, another $8 billion. And she said, that's all right. That's all right. We'll do that. So that palace is now labs. But there still are bedrooms with hand-painted ceilings. I have this wonderful picture. I take naps. I'm a nap person. And so I took a shot, and this beautiful hand-painted ceiling above me. It sort of made me feel I was in heaven. And then here's the epidemiological data collection on rare diseases that's coordinated into a regional center and then into a national center. So these are just a few quick snapshots out of this new book called Good Pharma, the model of the Mauro Negri Institute that will be out with Paul Greig McMillan next year. And it describes the ways in which they both take research and participate in public health action. So, for example, when there was a governmental crisis in the 90s, and this is a very trusted institute in highly politicized, corrupt Italy, and they turned over to Professor Garattini and the institute the responsibility for reviewing the national formulary. And so they went through and they eliminated ineffective or risky drugs and drugs with inadequate evidence. And that review led to a 30% reduction in total expenditures for the country in prescription drugs. And it's slowly been rising since then. So I don't know, it seems to me, it seems to Antonio and me and to others who are excited about this book and this project, it's the forwards by Sir Ian Chalmers, who founded the Cochrane Centers, that it could be a model for other nations and actually could be a model for universities and other research institutes to decommercialize R&D and to and I'll finish there. And there's a picture at dawn of the major institute. So, thank you. So they make money the way actually all other scientists make money. This is something we've forgotten now, and all, the way all medical science made money for decades and centuries. They get grants or contracts, and they do the work, end of story. I'm a sociologist. That's what we do in sociology. I don't know what you do in your discipline, but you know, this whole business of needing all this industry funding. I mean, am I giving the Pfizer lecture of November 19th? You know, yeah, you don't need sponsored speakers, and you don't need all this washing money. So they compete all the time. So it's all competitive grants and contracts from the EU, from the Italian government, from other governments, from charities. So I'm thinking of one person whose work on breast cancer is mainly funded by American charities that think their work is amongst the best in the world. And another interesting thing is when you don't patent, you can consider any active ingredient regardless of its patent status. So several non-patentable, promising drugs are being considered in research. So we should ask ourselves, do we want research and development to be focused only on patentable solutions or on any solution that's clinically promising? Well, the little handout is a summary of the book and then the chapters and then the key table that compares in two columns a commercialized R&D with the Mauro Negri model. And one whole chapter is devoted to another part of public health, which is the extensive criticism by Mauro Negri leaders of how the EMA and reviews and approves drugs, identifying the commercial biases, the lack of evidence of comparative advantage, and the lack of transparency and secrecy. So when Garattini, after he reduced the national budget by 30%, he became the Italian representative at the EMA and succeeded in getting several of the rules changed to increase transparency and accountability. But there's a long ways to go. You know, the EMA and the part of the FDA that reviews drugs are almost entirely funded by the companies who are submitting the drugs. So, you know, Merck submits a drug to be reviewed for approval, and about 90% of the staff who are doing the reviewing are being paid by Merck fees and other company fees. So we have this huge public body that's privately funded. And there's another literature on evidence of extensive bias between the FDA and the industry.
So is there a way to see which drugs are developed with transparent research, the kind you're describing, and which are not? Is there a way to look that up and see?
See, are you asking whether Mario Negri trial data are available? Yes.
Well, I'm asking, say I'm looking at two or three drugs, and one of them is on the market with research that's been done in a transparent way, as opposed to others which, you know, use the usual industry method. Is there some way to sort out which drugs are using research that is more transparent and
reliable? Yeah. Well, I think if you're a practicing physician, you wouldn't have time to find that out. So the larger systemic question, if in terms of a public health, pharmaceuticals for public health, would be why not just have all trials be based on blind competitive reviews with public data. But in the current situation, you can trace back and see who funded which trials. That's not too hard. It helps if you're near a school of pharmacy, because the libraries and schools of pharmacy have special, you know, $2,000 a year commercial sources that have a lot of that detail. And other libraries tend not to. Like at Princeton, we don't have any of that stuff, but the Merck Library down the street has it. Or the BSM or Johnson & Johnson libraries. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, say you're developing a Medicaid formulary for a whole state.
Uh-huh.
And then your decision was between drug A and drug B, and one of them you could vet it.
So I've never tried doing that, but I would think it's quite hard because of the cases that I do know about. I didn't explain. I'm just a mere sociologist who tries to read and think and write. So that's all I am. And so, for example, take Tamiflu. I mean, we're now in our sixth year, according to the string of articles, where the Cochrane Center and the leading reviewers are trying to identify which trials they don't know about and which trials results they don't know about and what Roche has made available and not made available. And, you know, so it's been years just on that one drug. And they have concluded, we can't tell whether Tamiflu is effective or not, because we only have part of the data, and we know we have several of we don't have the results of several trials with negative results.
I'm just wondering, kind of in response to this question, also chief epidemiologist at a school of pharmacy, and I'm wondering, would that be a good partnership for a state agency or a director of a state agency to partner with a school of pharmacy as sort of a public health project?
Yeah,
for them to
that'd be great. And it doesn't mean faculty and students are using it.
Right. Your students are always looking for projects that.
And also, to just chime in, you mentioned you're wondering whether the trial data is reliable or not. The question is not necessarily on whether the trial data is reliable or not, it's whether inferiority comparison, inferiority comparison, or superiority comparison. So the Me Too drugs, what we call the Me Too drugs, are just head to head. Dr. Light is suggesting another way of looking at it, which is actually proving that drug is superior to what's on the market. So that's some of the challenges of our regulatory.
So the market, yeah.
But I should just interrupt this delightful conversation just so we keep on track,
yes.
And we'll have some more time at the end for conversations as well. These are great questions.
Thank you. Please help me. Thanks, Dr. Height.